What are we going through here? I hope you guys, after an entire summer, you realize that you came here not just to intensify and to deepen all the Avodas Hashem that you can get in May and Heichal and Cedar Lane and Central Avenue and Power Line, whatever. But there's something here in this country. There's something here in these mountains. You can't just get it where you are. There's something additional. There's something here that all of a sudden you feel something a little different, not just more Torah, more Tefillah, and more learning and more Midos, but somehow it's like this whole new part of yourself has now come alive. A whole new voice of your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And you think about it when you're in Chutz Laaretz, and you think about it when you're in MTA, and you think about it when you're in Atlanta. Somehow here, the juices start flowing. Torah you can learn in Atlanta. Torah you can learn in Heichal. Torah you can learn in out. There's something here, the hills, the mountains, the people, smell. I don't know, it smells so great. But that smell. But it feels strong. It doesn't feel like, oh, it's my ideology and my kippah and my flag. It's like, oh my goodness. There's a whole new way for me to serve Hashem. I want to try and describe that to you tonight so you can maybe take it with you, bottle it, feel a little more deeply, and then maybe some point later in your life at some other stage come and learn to stitch it together. I say stitch it together because the last word that I will let anyone call me is a Zionist. I'm not a Zionist. You know why? Because when you use that word, you think of it as an ideology and a philosophy and a politics and a kippah. I care less about politics. I care less about ideology. To me, this whole thing you're part of here, it's part of my frumkeit. It's part of my tefillah, part of my Torah, part of my midos. It's a deep, deep part of my avodas Hashem. And to cheapen it by a flag or a kippah, in my personal expression is, I live in a place that's called Dativ Lomi, and that's my personal expression. You're going to have that feeling and have a different type of expression. That's what's important to me. It's not the expression, the feeling, and the attitude, and the mentality. Don't cheapen it. History has a beginning and an end. The beginning of history is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. The end of history, which is going to be in many ways very similar to the beginning, Chayei Shemayim together. Jewish history is a circle, not a line. We don't look towards an evolutionary future. We're trying to reclaim. Not like we're going to walk around in carts and donkeys and plant fields. Still going to have technology. Still going to have cars. Still going to have planes. If anything, the march of technology is a sign of it. Because Hashem wants human beings to advance towards a better state. It's a better condition. AI is not a klala. AI is a bracha. Kadosh Baruch Hu is giving us the ability to farm out some of the manual labor. The fact that you have indoor plumbing. And the fact that we have medical treatment. And the fact that we're not dying at the age of 50 like we did 100 years ago. Means we have more time, more resources, and then that's the challenge. How to use those resources. Don't ever cast the following word as the antithesis of religion, because you will be trapping yourself in a very, very dark and backward place. You know how people say, oh, that person's not so religious, they're more modern? Mm-hmm. Modernity is not the antithesis of religion. Every single person, by definition, is a modern Jew compared to the person that lived 50 years beforehand, or compared to the you of a day before, because every day modernity introduces new obstacles. Now you can decide, you know what, I want to hold back on modern conventions, they're too dangerous. That's fine, that's a legitimate approach. Or you can decide I'm going to early adopt this book. I was once on a plane with a chassid about 20 years ago. They asked me to explain to him computers. I have a degree in computer science. And he's a very enlightened person, a very thoughtful person, but he just had no exposure to computers. He really thought there was a little person inside the computer box running around giving answers. And I explained to him how it worked. And after a very respectful conversation, I said to him, do you know that in 20 years, you won't be able to pay your bills or get information or access without internet? And he looked at me with a very wise answer, and he said, yeah, but at least I will have bought 20 years of safety. And I thought I was talking to a caveman. Turns out he was talking to a guinea pig. Get it? I was his guinea pig. I was the one that was trying out this early adoption and making all the mistakes and learning how to use it properly, and he was going to benefit from all my mistakes and trial and error. So you make a choice. The advantage of early adoption is you learn how to harness these tools. I happen to say, because I studied computers in college, I think I was one of the first people to realize the Torah capacity on the internet. I'm sure a lot of people have eclipsed me and transcended. But in the early 90s, I started writing Lum this year on the internet. Simple little emails, text-based, it wasn't MP3s, it wasn't podcasts. But it really sped a lot of Torah in an era in which a lot of Torah wasn't available. Now, was my early adoption of the internet, was it fraught with issues? Did it? Of course. I wish I wouldn't have seen certain things in German that made me see, or I was unable to filter out of my world. And I can totally appreciate someone wants to shut down. But there are two different ways. Don't tell yourself that tale that modernity is not from. Modernity are options, right? I would love to have a milkshake tonight. I love milkshakes. Hint, hint, someone's going to buy you a milkshake. I'd be really happy. Okay, as much as I love a milkshake, my body physique can't handle it. If I have a milkshake, every night, a balloon in a way that I don't want to. So it's a cost benefit. I would like a milkshake, but I hold back because I'd rather have a healthier physique and healthier pulmonary system, whatever, not kill my arteries. So same thing with modernity. There are opportunities. The opportunities come with risks. You have to decide whether to engage in it. Modernity doesn't, and if you decide to engage in modernity, it's not that you're less from, it's that you're deciding that the benefits outweigh the risks for you. And another person will decide, you know, for me, the benefits don't outweigh the risk. But if you keep telling yourself that narrative that modernity means not from, then you know what happens when you're involved in modernity, you're convinced you're not being from. And then you become schizophrenic. You're from the base matters, you're from when you're dominating, when you're on your cell phone, and when you're, you know, watching a game, when you're on the internet, well, I'm not really being from that, because modernity isn't from, so I'm out. I'm basically, at best, neutral. At worst, I'm dividing myself, compartmentalizing myself into different parts. And it wouldn't be organic, it wouldn't be a whole. It wouldn't be from that every minute. It wouldn't be from every single moment of your life. It's the same thing with Zionism. If I had one chance to change something in high school, I got a lot of things on that list. But one of the things on my list, you made me the president of every single high school, Melvin Perman, right? Melvin Perman, president of all the high schools. You know what my first prerogative would be? Instead of, many of you don't even have studying about Eretz Yisrael, but some of you that do, it happens 3:30 in the afternoon, it's not part of the Moody Kodesh, and Mrs. Greenberg comes in and teaches you about Herzl and Golda Meir and the Yom Kippur War. I would call an Avas Eretz Yisrael and it would be part of the Moody Kodesh. Right after Gemara, before Chumash, we'd sit there and learn, what does it mean to be part of this country? What does it mean to be part of history? Why did Hashem choose us? I don't know why Hashem chose us, but I know He chose us. I don't know how long this process will last, but I know it started. I don't know what the signs are, but 6 million Jews returning to this country and finding safe haven after 2,000 years of bloodletting and 2,000 years of persecution and Torah flourishing like it never did and the land being fertile all of a sudden. I don't know, but something's happening. And that something is the beginning of the end. And how long will that beginning of the end take? Despite what Masha Obeni Mamin Lechem Abeita, Ani Lo Shechna. Ani Lo Petichut. I can't say anything. I just know that the fourth period of Jewish history has begun. The first period of Jewish history was 2,448 years until Matan Torah. We didn't have divine revelation. We didn't have Nevuah. We sketched our way towards a very vague knowledge of Hashem, and of course, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were able to find Hashem and teach it to us and teach it to their children and teach it to and follow Hashem's will and live a moral lifestyle and marry only one wife or two wives, but not hundreds of wives, and worship only one God, not hundreds of gods. And then all of a sudden, 2,448 years into history, Hashem came down on that mountain and spoke to every single one in this room. Anochi Hashem. Shema Yisrael. And for the next 1,400 years, we lived with Nisan, and with Gilei Shechina, and with Nevuah. You know how many Nevi'im were walking around? Weren't 48 Nevi'im. There were 48 Nevi'im who wrote about the future of Jewish history. There were thousands of Nevi'im. Can you imagine every month sitting down with the Nevi'im and saying, what does Hashem want from me? And the Navi looked into your neshama and said, you know what Hashem wants from you? This is what Hashem wants from you. A lot more direct sense of what you should do in life than babbling and dabbling around to find your place in life. Direct line, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Amazing world. Imagine a world of cause and effect. Every time you sin, you get corona. You're not sinning too fast. We live in a world in which there's a disconnect between cause and effect. That's called Hester Panim. We commit an avera and we walk scot-free. You may like it that way, but there's no deterrent.
There's no incentive. There's no accountability. You do what you want, and you pay the bill later. And you know what happens when you pay the bill later? The interest grows. Imagine that world, in which every time you were violated, don't raise your hand. When's the last time you violated Shabbos b'shogeg? I'm not doing it with Chal Shabbos b'mesid. Right? Everyone's hand's got to be up at some point last month. You don't know something, you made a mistake, you this, you that, you that, you this. Okay, come tomorrow to Yerushalayim and let's shell out for a cow, or shell out for a goat, and not really a cow, a goat or a sheep, and it costs you a couple $1,000. You'll be a lot more careful, Parshas Re'eh, than you were Parshas Akif. Trust me. It's a whole different ball game. Second period, great period to live, Jewish sovereignty. Yerushalayim was the center of the world. Everyone came to Yerushalayim to learn about Hashem. And we succeeded until we did it. And we threw it all away. And we broke history. And we failed history. And then Hashem kicked us out of Yerushalayim 1900 years ago. And we wander this earth from continent to continent, from country to country, from pogrom to pogrom, from Inquisition to Crusade, from Chmielnytskyi Rebellion in Poland in the 17th century, 300,000 Jews possibly to the Spanish. Bouncing around, ricocheting through history, never giving up our faith. And being tested one final time with the biggest test of them all. You know the biggest test of them all? Holocaust. The worst attack on the Jewish people since the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And yet we survived. We didn't just survive. We turned around 3 years later. We came back to our country. And we stood in tall defiance to an entire world that doesn't want us here. And we still are. Why do you think I live in the Gush? I'm not looking for a life of comfort. I'm looking for a life of prophecy. To look for a life of prophecy, you have to go to the land of prophecy. If you want a life of comfort, I live in the five towns. Better restaurants, better cars, better houses. I live in Silver Spring, where I got that nice little water fountain right near this giant supermarket. It's all so nice and woods. And I don't want comfort. I want prophecy. And now we've started that fourth period. So don't sit there and worry and argue, is it yes, Reishis Michas Gula Seinu, is it not? Is it, should we hold the flag? Should we? I don't know. These things, I'm just a simple person from Brooklyn. I don't get any of these things. One thing I do get. It started. The fourth period of history has begun. We're in that fourth stage. We're back in our country. 8 million, 7 million Jews live here. We have Torah like we haven't had in... I once asked Rav Schechter. I was just talking to Rav Schechter before. I was driving with him in a car, and I'd say, Rebbe, Rav Lichtenstein told me, a too good eidim. Rav Lichtenstein told me the following statement, which you agree or disagree. There's more Torah being studied in today's world than at any point since the first Beis HaMikdash. That's 2,600 years ago. Rav Schechter looked at me and said, like, of course there's more. I'm not saying the level of Torah. Let me tell you what I was doing when I was your age. I'm going to NCSY Kollel for the summer. There was an NCSY Kollel for the summer. Some other time I'll tell you what I was doing for my summers. It wasn't learning Torah. You know how many boys were in the great yeshivas? A great period that is responsible for so much of our energy in the Torah world today. In the pre-World War I yeshivas, maybe 5,000. For goodness sakes, there are 10,000 boys living in Mir as we speak, and another 10,000 in Lakewood. And so something's happening. Torah, the land was a wasteland for 2,000 years. The best, strongest empires tried to settle this land, from the Muslims to the Turks to the British to the conquerors to the Christians. No one. This land, you know, anyone here, Muhammad Ali? Muhammad Ali was the best boxer. He could have taken Pike Tyson and eaten him for breakfast. He would have put Tyson on a wheel on skates. That's how smooth he was. Tyson was an animal. You got to know how to use animals' aggressions against us. Tyson would come charging in. Muhammad would be dancing around. I'd be moving away and bringing his energy. Muhammad Ali knew how to move. He got the footwork. Go YouTube one time and look at Muhammad Ali's footwork. Then he also had a game that he would play with the opponent. We'd go in the corner, put his hands like this, and let the opponent take a couple shots to the side midriff, waste his energy, lull him to sleep, and then whack him one. So Muhammad Ali, this is called the rope-a-dope. He'd stand in the corner, ropes on either side, so that each shot would be a little bit deflected. He's going to the rope-a-dope, guy would hit him a couple times, then we'd turn around and whack him. What was I talking about before, how to get to Muhammad Ali? Who can help me trace back?
Israel, we slammed.
Right. This is like the rope-a-dope. Okay, like Muhammad Ali. You want to try to settle? Take your best shot, Crusaders. You want to try to settle? Take your best shot, Turks. You want to try to settle? Take your best shot. And then, boom! 20th century comes. Two big wars. Each of them lead us back to our country. You think these are wars? They're not wars. They're roads back to Israel. Without World War I, the Ottoman Empire doesn't fall. Without the Ottoman Empire not falling, we don't get invited back to this country. You heard the Balfour Declaration? Right after World War I. Without World War II, sadly, we don't come back to our people. Because of all the changing shifts and the lines being redrawn in the Jewish refugee issue, you have to learn to see history, not just through universal lenses, but everything. You think 1776 is important for the United States of America? Who cares? I'm sure there are other reasons Kodesh Baruch Hu brought the United States of America into reality. But one of the reasons are so that 200 years later they can help the Jews back to their country. What happened on Bunker Hill in 1776 was only important because of what happened on Har Moriah in 1967. Without 1967, there's no need for 1776. Because everything that happens in this world is driven towards one and only one endpoint, and that is redemption. Yeah, redemption has many parts. Your democracy is part of redemption, as Kodesh Baruch Hu wants us to police each other more equitably, more fairly. Science is part of redemption. Philosophy, where it's taken properly, is part of redemption. Technology is part of it. It's all part. You think this is all the fact that we're living in a better world is, like I said before, you think it's neutral to religion? You think it's opposed to religion? No, Kodesh Baruch Hu is bringing us to a place. We don't have to work as hard. We don't have to eat as hard. I was with my kids as we were going to field. And we were walking through fields and grass, and I was pointing out we had passed by some sheep. I was commenting to my son, do you know how many hours a sheep spends grazing a day? You know how many hours it takes for a sheep to provide the energy for its basic sustenance? And believe me, sheep don't have internet, they don't think, they don't write books, they don't run marathons. Got a pretty simple life, and yet they have to eat 10 hours a day. Because the energy is coming from the sun, and through photosynthesis it gets embedded in the green leaves. There's very little that energy gets embedded. And then in order to provide energy and to consume energy, they need a lot of leaves. Imagine you're an elephant. How much you have to eat because they're very herbivores. How much plant life and fruit life and vegetables have to eat. And then we just take the meat, which has taken all that energy, because animals take all that energy from the sun, that's been photosynthesized into the leaves, and they eat 10 hours a day. And then we just take a piece of meat with that compacted energy. We eat the meat, we have enough energy for the rest of the day. So how's it? The economization of human experience is Chasdei Hashem. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu lets us be more efficient, of course, it's a challenge. What do we do with efficiency? We have more leisure time. A lot of people are wasting their leisure time. It's called Netflix. It's called addiction to YouTube. So leisure time is also a challenge. But the concept of leisure time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is freeing us from the curse of Adam. What's the curse of Adam? To work. That's a Vachatal Balechem. That's Adam's curse. He used to live in Gan Eden, and everything was provided through AI. Everything is provided automatically. And Hashem is returning us to Gan Eden and saying, now earn it. Now live it. Stop vilifying modernity. Stop vilifying. You're just shooting yourself in the leg. You're training your mind to work backwards. And once you train your mind that way, you'll always be backwards. You're like walking, put your shoes on backwards. Try walking that way. You're not going to get anywhere. It's a challenge you have to learn. Some people say it's too much of a challenge. You're going to hold off. Doesn't mean it's criminal. It means that for me, the risks outweigh the benefits. Never going to hold off a little like the chassid on the plane, going to hold off entirely. That's legitimate. But don't criminalize it. That's what's happening to us, guys. And that's what you're starting to feel here. I hope you're starting to feel there's something in this country that you just can't get built on. You just can't get. Doesn't mean you have to live in here. No, there's something here in the air. There's something here that Hashem is changing history on us. I don't know when it's going to end, you know how it's going to end, you know how to call it. You can say hello, you don't say hello, you wear a flag, you don't wear a flag, you serve in the army, you know, everyone's got their expression. My personal expression, and vis-a-vis my Kansas, I feel the best way to blend all of that is to learn Torah and serve in the army. Then another person will come in and say, you know what, the best way I feel to blend all of that is to sit and learn Torah day and night, because that's going to provide the spiritual energy for the events of our redemptive process. You know what? I'm totally on board with that. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates different drachim, and Hashem allows different people to be part of it. It's not the expression. It's not the way you choose to define it and to color it, to flavor it. Do you feel that you are part of a new stage in history? Do you feel that for some reason, I can't explain it to you, I don't know why Hashem selected me, and not the Chassam Sofer's generation, and not the Groz generation, and not the Maharal's generation, because when I look at it through logical lenses, those generations seem a lot more suited to be chosen than mine. But you know what? You can't look at Gula through these lenses. You look at Halacha through logic. You got to look at Gula. You got to flip the lenses. It's prophecy. And you don't understand it. That's why so many people that get Halacha don't get prophecy. Got it? Or go to the optician, and he plays with those lenses on you, and he gets all blurry. It's a different process. Halacha is logical. Daf Beis, Daf Gimel, Daf Dalet, Daf Hey. Gula, by definition, is illogical because it's not here. You can't describe something that's not here through logic. They describe it through something else. Why were you born? How many of you guys, about 15, 16, most of you? Why the heck were you born in 2007 and not in 1907? And you know what? That's all the difference in the world. If you've been born in 1907 rather than 2007, instead of sitting here all dainty with your petunias on your cola, eating your yummies and your water, having a good time in Florida, you'd be hiding in sewers from Hitler's executioners. You'd be watching your parents gunned down on stone walls. You'd be thrown into pits with corpses. People coming and putting a bullet into the back of your neck. Your lives would be hell, and you'd be living through a nightmare. And it's 100 years, not 1,000 years away. And you know what's the answer to that question? No one has the answer to why. I have the answer to what does it mean. I know the answer to why. Why did Hashem put my ancestor back in those pits and me into this world? I don't know why. And I know why. I know that privilege always comes with responsibility. If I just soak up the privilege just to enjoy my life and have a better life for myself and a better car and a better home and a better this and a better that, I'm defrauding Hashem. Hashem put me into this world like He put you into a world in which you've been selected, and which history is moving forward, not going backwards, light, not darkness, triumph, not suffering. We have our state, we have our Torah, we have Batei Medrash. Now do something with it. And for each person, the answer to that question is different. But I haven't talked about politics or ideology. I've talked about Frankheim. I've talked about my Avodas Hashem. And that's something I beg you, please take with you back. Doesn't mean you should go back wearing a kippah sugah or carrying a gun. They won't let you on the plane with a gun or destroying the army. Each person, follow your derech. But try to find that voice in your derech that can only be heard here in Eretz Yisrael. And it doesn't mean you have to live here because it's a very complicated world. Most of you won't end up living here until Mashiach comes. But there's a difference between living in Chutz La'aretz with your passport as an American passport, but your heart is in Eretz Yisrael, or just completely oblivious to what's happening. Completely oblivious. Remember a couple of years ago, right? Have you been following a little bit of the news here when you're in the summer? A little bit of the terror that happened? A little bit more, you know, there's a terror attack over Shabbos, and an Israeli was killed. I know some of the older boys probably know what it is to hear about the terror attacks. It's only the Israelis. I always tell Americans, your first stop in the morning, when you open your browser, or you're looking for notifications, has to be what's happening in Israel. It can't be that people are being killed in the streets of Tel Aviv to build the country that one day you and your grandchildren will live in, and the first thing you look at are the Yankees. It can't be. That's repugnant. It can't be. One day, when you're older, let me tell you personal stories. I speak in a lot of places across the world. And I try to give people real challenges to be part of Eretz Yisrael. And I don't expect you to face this challenge now because you're still young, but I'll plant the seed in the back of your head, and maybe one day it will grow, but at least you'll understand what I'm talking about, and I'll back it up with a personal story. People ask me, what can we do? I say, you know what you can do? On a day in which there's a terrible pigur in Israel, Baruch Hashem, we've had fewer, but they come. Chas v'shalom, we shouldn't have any more. But if there's a terrible pigur in Eretz Yisrael, and that day you were planning on going to the Oriole game, or to the Braves game, or going out to eat, or having a really fun day, I say this to parents, not the kids, and I'll tell you why later in a moment. There is absolutely no excuse for us to be standing here in Eretz Yisrael by freshly cut graves, burying heroes of history, while you're sitting there at a baseball stadium with 60,000 drunk people screaming their heads off for people in pajamas hitting balls off the wall. Be ashamed of yourself. You'd be embarrassed to be there. Take those tickets, give them to a Gentile friend, rip them up, toss them in the garbage. Remember, your dignity and your conscience are always more valuable than your wallet. Don't ever confuse the two. Don't ever let money stand in the way of dignity. Always be willing to pay a price for dignity, because once you lose it, you can never recover it. Once you lose your conscience, you can't recover it. Don't ever place money ahead of dignity or conscience. Don't ever let the money you can find. Money comes and goes. Conscience is hard to build once it breaks. So about 17 years ago, right around now, most of my kids are married already, but at that point, none of them were, obviously. I'm not a richy rich guy. It's not like we can afford to take our kids for the summer to all types of distant, exotic locations. We had big 8 kids in our family. So we planned, what do we do during the summer? A fuel here and a fuel there, pizza here and ice cream there. And there was one day during the summer, we bought tickets to a very expensive amusement park in Israel. Believe me, nothing like Six Flags, believe me. It was a silly little Israeli park, but for us it was expensive. That was the day we planned, the whole family's going to go away. And you have to purchase those tickets in advance. We bought them 3 months in advance, but we had the tickets. Whatever it was beyond our budget. And that day was the day that 8,000 Jews were forcibly removed from their homes in Gaza. You know about that? When Jews used to live on the coast of Israel, what's currently Gaza, where the Arabs live. The Israelis know it was a really sad day to see 8,000 Jews being removed by the Jewish army. I'm not saying politically, yes, it was just a really sad scene. See, people were forcibly, there was crying and tears, and the grave sites were ultimately violated by the Arabs. They burnt Bate Knesset when we left the land. There's a part of the coast called Gaza where we used to have settlements, and we voluntarily withdrew to try to create peace. Unfortunately, it boomeranged in our face. And the Israeli army forced the Jewish settlers to move out of their homes. And my wife and I woke up and we saw scenes on the television about all these kids and their parents being taken out of their homes, being pulled from their homes, pulled from their beds, in their pajamas, pulled from their shawls, pulled from the graves of their grandparents who were buried there. And my wife and I said, how the heck are we going to go and have a great old time celebrating in the Jewish park today when 8,000 Jews are suffering this trauma? Just basic menschlichkeit. Are you part of one people or you're not? Part of living in Eretz Yisrael, maybe you felt this a little, all of a sudden, we're all one family. On the bus, you've met a bus driver who can quote Tanakh better than you can, right? And he doesn't wear a kippah, but he feels so Jewish, right? The guy in the falafel store, the Baba Sali, and the Baba Cherebi, what does this mean? Like, he's not wearing a hat and a jacket, but he feels so Jewish. And what does it mean to live with one big Jewish family? When you live in Hechal or Tinak or Bergenfield, you're hiding from one hopscotch in Judaism. From the shul, to the shul, to the Beis Knesset, to the school, to the kosher supermarket. Now, if you live in New York, the hopscotch is a little shorter, right? Because it's all fairly clustered. If you live in Atlanta, you're really hopscotching. Because you're really living on small little islands of Judaism and a big sea of Gentiles, right? But it's the same hopscotching. You're still jumping. Here, no one's hopscotching. We're just living together, one big Jewish experience. Some keep more mitzvahs, some keep less mitzvahs. One day they'll keep all the mitzvahs. We're waiting for that day. It's all Jewish. Everything is Jewish. So you know how my wife and I decided? We went to the mission. Because for me and her, we didn't have the time to do it. But our little 8-year-old kids and 9-year-old kids, what do they know? This is their one day. But we went with broken hearts. And believe me, there were other sad times in our life here in Israel where as adults, when the kids weren't involved, we shut it down. Like when there were terror incidents, we had a big family gathering in the night restaurant, we can't go. We have a way to calibrate, unfortunately, when these things occur. So I'm not asking you at the age of 16, 17, to make such bold decisions. Oh, we're going to terror incident over the summer. All right, tickets to the Met game. You're still young. Have a good time. Enjoy yourself. But at least check in. Crying with our people. I remember a long time ago. Why? I can't remember the name of the story. A kid asked me, he said, Rabbi, why should I come to Eretz Yisrael to learn? What's different in Eretz Yisrael to learn? I said, let me ask you what I asked him. Two questions. I said, it was Erev Shabbos. I think I was Silver Spring. No, I'm just kidding. It was Erev Shabbos. And I put a sitter in front of him. I said, tonight, you're going to sing Lech Hadodi. You know where these sections are from? The sections that talk about, wake up my people, wipe off the dust, this narin me afar, hisari, sari, kivarech, lo se lo shi, lo se komi, matashtachim, don't be embarrassed, yes, it's a life. Beautiful songs of
redemption or it's a confront. He looked at him with a blank stare. I said, okay, I'm not gonna blame you for not knowing where they come from. I'll tell you what, let's stop the interview. Here's the Tanakh. Open up to Yeshaya. I'll show you where these beautiful prophecies come from. He didn't move a bone. I said, no, this is a part of the show. Show you. He said, Rebbe, I don't know where Yeshaya is. So I said, let me ask you something. Is at least knowing where Sefer Yeshaya is part of being firm? Is at least knowing what the difference between Yeshaya's Nevuah is, not quoting Yeshaya chapter and verse, but knowing that Yeshaya generally, generalizing here for you, speaks about consolation. Yirmiyah generally speaks about moral reprimand, generally. Hosea, Habakkuk, how many Svarim of Tanakh after Malachim can you name? And if you can name them, how many of them can you order? I'm talking about becoming the next great Tanakh thinker and teacher. Just basic conversance, basic familiarity. Is that part of being for? And then I asked them, I said, tell me. This is 30 years ago. There was a terrible, terrible helicopter accident where two Israeli helicopters of the army took off for an excursion into Lebanon. This is when we still were in Lebanon in a security strip. And two helicopters collided in midair, and 72 soldiers were killed in a flash. I said, what did you do when you heard about that accident? The boy was a good boy. He said, oh, we heard about the accident. My family got together. He said something to him. So let me tell you what we did that night in Eretz Yisrael when we heard about this accident. It was on the TV. 72 Levites in 48 hours. Can you imagine? My wife and I sat in front of the TV set and we cried. And we cried. And we cried. Till we had no tears left. One family after another broken by tragedy. And not just a tragedy, a car accident on 695. Tragedy because they were willing to sacrifice their lives for you. I said, tell me something. Is the ability to cry, not just to feel bad when there's suffering in Israel, but to cry with your people, is that also part of being firm? I said, it was. He says, evidently, there are parts of firm that you just can't get as deeply as you can get them in Israel. And part of coming to Israel is not just deepening the Torah and the Halacha and the davening, but stretching it. Stretching it. Pouring your funkai into areas that you don't visit as much when you're in Chutzlars. You hear about them, you talk about them. I know when I'm in Chutzlars, I feel them less. When I'm away for 2 weeks, I feel it less. Because distance dulls it and detaches it and severs it. When you're here, guys, that's what I hope you're starting to feel come alive in your heart. Because it's in your heart. Because this is your land. This won't be your land. This will one day be your home. Your home, your grandson's home, your great-great-grandson's home. And I'm here for you. I moved here for you. And everyone that's here has a choice to be here. And we are here. Some people are building settlements like I am. And other people are learning farming. Everyone made a decision to throw it all away. And I made that decision in 1993 to throw it all away. Not a lot to throw away. I wanted to be here. For me, first and most, because I felt like my Avodas Hashem is more complete here. And part of my complete Avodas Hashem is I want to be here for our people. And someone's got to be here. If I haven't been in Gush Etzion for the last 4 years, I don't know that it would have grown at the same pace. Everyone contributes their own little part. Now there are 50,000 people living in the Gush. 4,000 people. That's something I'm personally proud of. It's not like I'm the mayor of Gush. I'm the, I don't know, the head designer of Gush. But everyone gives their role. People come and I taught yeshiva. And people come and move. And people feel it, guys. Feel it. When you see a secular Israeli, you're looking at someone who lost their Torah, lost their mitzvahs, but they're still holding on to something deep, and that is Hashem put into every Jewish heart the ability to identify with their people, with their land, and with their history, even if they're not identified with Torah mitzvahs. Secular Israelis are not off the radar. Unfortunately, they've lost much of our tradition. But they're still holding on to something.
You think secular Zionism is a bungle of history? You know how many millions and millions of Jews today are holding on to their Judaism solely because of their commitment to the land of Israel? You know them, right? I have to tell the guys who live out of town, you know them much more. Most of the guys that live in New York, you live in cluster ghettos, where the only people you meet are more or less Orthodox Jews like yourself, right? Show of hands. This is nothing embarrassing. Guys who live in New York, guys who live in the Five Towns, guys who live in Teaneck. How many hours have you spent with non-Orthodox Jews? I imagine it's less than 10, if at all, right? Guys in Atlanta, how many hours have you spent with non-Orthodox Jews? A lot. Guys even in Silver Spring, a lot, right? Because when you live in concentrated Jewish areas, you cluster around Orthodox Jews, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But all of a sudden, you meet these Jews, and you see how deep Israel is a part of their life. And where would they be without Israel? I don't know why Hashem chose a secular form of nationalism to return us to our country. Truth is, I think I do know. Because in the 19th century, religion collapsed across the world. Christianity fell apart. Organized Islam fell apart because humanity awoke after the Dark Ages. This is, of course, the Age of Reason, the Age of Science. It started earlier, 16th century, science, reason, ration, humanism, enlightenment, democracy, religion? Yuck! The great culprit of history, bloodshed, war, discrimination, repression, persecution, that's crazy religious fanatics. 19th century was a secular century. All of religion started to collapse. You know what replaced religion? I'll teach you. It's called nationalism. What do I mean by nationalism? If you go back to the 14th century and you meet a person walking down a street in London, you know how he would introduce himself? Hi, my name is John. Let's say 1700s. Make it more current. 1700s. My name is John. I'm a Protestant. I happen to live in England, but I'm a Protestant. He defined himself by religion. Then you went to France and you met a person. Hi, my name is Gustav. I'm a Catholic. I happen to live in France. And then you went to Egypt and said, hi, my name is Ishmael. I'm a Muslim. I happen to live in Egypt, but I'm a Muslim. You define yourself by religion. Now it's 1880. No one defines himself by religion anymore. It's all outdated voodoo, hocus pocus. Repressive. You meet that same John in England. You know what he says? Hi, my name is John. I'm an Englishman. I happen to be a Protestant. Hi, my name is Gustav from Paris. I'm a Frenchman. I happen to be a Catholic. Hi, my name is Ishmael. I'm part of the Egyptian nation. I happen to be a Muslim. People define themselves by nationhood, not by religion, because religion is now bunk. Don't lie to yourselves. The 19th century wasn't just a century in which religion collapsed across the world. Judaism collapsed also. This is a great, great summer, and you're celebrating NCSY Kollel. For every one person here on this call, I'm not talking about the Kollel. How many other NCSY programs are there? Jolt, and what are some of the other programs? Help me out here. Ambassador, or TJJ, still have TJJ? Right, so how many kids are here? 800? All together, 1,000? 1,000 kids. Do the math, guys. How many Jewish kids your age, just in America, are totally unconnected with anything Jewish? Probably 10 to 1. For every one of you here, this isn't a Musa Shmuz to go do Kira. I'm just trying to get a reality check here. Instead of beating ourselves on the chest, just realize how many Jews we lost to religion. How many Jews left religion? A long time ago, I was a rabbi in Hask. And they had shtetl day. Because on Sundays, the therapists don't come to give the kids therapy because they're off. The kids need heavy therapy, so every Sunday is another challenge to make programming for the special needs kids. So under that shtetl day, let's recreate the shtetl. They brought mud, and they brought cow manure, and they brought donkeys, and we're going to recreate the shtetl. So I was the rabbinic consultant. How to best recreate the shtetl in Camp Hask. So I joked with one of the older staff, I would never tell the kids this, you know, if you really want to recreate the shtetl, 9 out of 10 people have to be off the derech. Because that's what it was like in the shtetl. Once modernity stepped into Eastern Europe, it ran through Eastern Europe like wildfire. I keep telling you, 6,000 boys maybe in yeshivas. There were more boys enrolled in Russian universities in 1925 than all the yeshivas together. And the University of Moscow was a den of heresy. It wasn't YU, it wasn't Penn, it wasn't John Hopkins. It was, you go to the University of Moscow, you're becoming a kofar. You're walking out of religion. Period. Why do you think so many of the Gedolim in the 20s and 30s didn't want people going to college? Because of the Bittul Torah. Because these were dens of kavir. You walk into college, you're losing your dimuras. There's a point to be made of Bittul Torah. I'm not saying that you shouldn't oppose college with Bittul Torah. But the old classic Rebaruch Ber concern about college was, ask your rabbi and Harry Saul, they'll confirm. The big problem was, you become a kofar. Today, who becomes a kofar in college? You don't listen to the professors anyway. You don't even show up. You just take the okay, you're talking, you do want a degree, you don't want a degree, co-ed, not co-ed. It's a legitimate conversation, yes, to go to college, not to go to college. But the conversation isn't the conversation of 1920 in Sabbath. 1920, the conversation against college was, it's all kfir, and you're going to walk off the derech. And there were millions of Jews in the 19th century who were all about to be lost to Judaism. And Hashem had to find a way to keep them engaged in Judaism. And to keep them in tow for the end of history. And it couldn't be religion because religion wasn't popular in the 19th century. So you know what Hashem found? Jewish nationalism. I'll say it again. The ability to relate to people, land, history, even if you don't keep mitzvahs and Torah. It's only half of the equation, but it's still part of the equation. And you've met those Jews over the summer. That's the taxi cab driver who doesn't wear a kippah, learns Tanakh. I remember I was taking a cab a couple years ago to the airport. Like, it was after Shabbos, and I had a very spiritual Shabbos because I learned an hour in the afternoon. I'd take a nap, and I was going to teach Torah. And my cab driver picked me up, and he wasn't from. He wanted to get on a kippah. It's like, how was your Shabbos? Yeah, I went through Tehillim 7 times. I said, whoa. Okay. Can't touch that. He didn't have a beard. He didn't have a kippah. I don't know what he did on Shabbos. He just had Tehillim 7 times. Pashat Yidden. People who express their Yiddishkeit, their Judaism, a little bit different. I'm not saying you should become them, God forbid. But you're seeing something different here. And those are the sounds and smells you felt this summer. Try to think about it the next couple of days. I'm not going to be able to be here next Sunday night because you have a banquet. This is really the last time we're meeting each other. Try to pick up some of this smell and one day come back to it. One day you can come back to Eretz Yisrael. You get to live here for a year or two, come to yeshiva. Some of you will stay longer. Some of you will make aliyah. It is not ideology. It's not Zionism. It's a neshama. It's Hashem calling you in a different way. And that's the difference between going to Moreshav, or Moshava, or Masora, or Ayo, whatever you want, and coming here for the summer. And with all the hardships it may have taken this summer, because it was scorching hot, and the food wasn't as good as it would have been in fill in the blanks, and the sports wasn't as incredible as it would have been. And you miss your girlfriend. I don't know your girlfriend, but the other boys miss their girlfriend. Not you guys, because you're the Kedoshim. You know what? It was all worth it. Because you got something this summer that you just can't get in the Catskills of the Poconos. And be proud of yourselves. And hold on to it. And it's young, I know things are going to disappear at some point, but you met people that talked about it, I'm sure. And you met me, and you met... All of a sudden, there's something here. We're pretty serious about this. It isn't a flag. It isn't a kippah. It isn't an ideology. It isn't a program. Not a Zionist. I don't know those things. Hashem, we're so close. I can walk to Yerushalayim and put my hands on the kotel. I can go to my backyard and mow my grass. I can go to Makola and just be with Yidden. I can live with my family. I can live in my country. My Zaydi, one of the Bochanan Wasserman. In World War I, a lot of the big yeshivas had to go into Gullus. About 30 yeshivas around the start of the war, 30 big yeshivas in Europe. Because the war was so centered in the Polish, Ukrainian, Latvian area, so a lot of the yeshivas were affected by it. About a third of them closed. About a third of them didn't survive the war. Most of those that survived the war basically moved eastward into Russia. Many people know about the famous Nir movement to Shanghai in World War II, but most of the yeshivas were in transit during World War I. So my Zaydi learned from Baltimore, learned with the Bochanan when they moved from Radin, which was the yeshiva of the Chavetz Chaim, to Smilovitz, one of the cities in Russia, they moved, or Ukraine, whatever, they moved a little further east in Poland. Interesting, as I told you last time, how Ukraine and Jews have a very hard history. But this actually, for a certain pocket of time, Ukraine hosted a lot of the yeshivas. Around 1918, 1919, there was a lot of internal politics in Ukraine that led to a lot of pogroms, but at least in the initial part of the war, the Jews didn't want to be near Germany, they wanted to be back in Russia, but then when the communists took over Russia, they basically caught between a rock and a hard place. They didn't want to be facing the Germans, they weren't Nazis, but they were very unfair and discriminatory to the Jews. They didn't want to be in Russia because the communists were banned from religion, so they had to find this like little mid-area called the Ukraine. He moved to Baltimore in the early 20s as a penniless single, and he brought over his whole family. Today there are hundreds and hundreds of his descendants that thank God are all from. He told me the following story about why he moved. He was walking home in white Russia one day from shul, Shabbos morning. He was a bar mitzvah boy. And a Russian soldier barks at him and says, "Jew, come here!" He's running over a 13-year-old grandfather. And the Russian soldier says, "You have 20 minutes. Go home, collect your belongings, kiss your parents goodbye. I am requisitioning you into the Russian army as my weapons bearer." Well, it wasn't shooting, wasn't to kill him, was to have him forced labor. So I asked my grandfather, I said, "Zadie, what did you do?" He took my hand in his hand. His hand was like snakeskin. Because when he moved to Baltimore, it was a 6-day work week. 97% of the Jews in Baltimore were Chal Shabbos. They were Shomer Shabbos, but they had to work on Shabbos. 90%, 80%. He refused to. So finally, the only job he could get to be Shomer Shabbos was to shuck chickens in the cold Baltimore winter. It's pretty cold, right? And he had blood running down his hands all day long, freezing cold. So I know what happens when your hands are all moist and freezing cold. Wear gloves. You can't wear gloves. You're sleeping. He said, "What choice did I have? If I wanted to go in with this Russian soldier, they would have hunted down my parents and shot them." Ultimately, he brought his parents over. I met his father. I met my great-grandfather, which in those days was unheard of. You guys will probably meet, and maybe you even know your great-grandfather. The only friend of mine had a great-grandfather, because all that I killed in the Holocaust, we had grandparents. I was always haunted about my son living in fear of Russian soldiers. I came to the war. 2 years after I met Aliyah, it was Hanukkah night. I was driving home through Beit Lechem. There was no bypass. I was driving through the Arab territory, getting to the Gush. And all of a sudden, I see a police in my rearview mirror, the lights, hear the sirens, pull over to the side. A policewoman comes out, says, "Hey, Fabi Shayon, where's your license?" He starts writing out a ticket to me. I sat there, and I broke down crying. Not because of the ticket. I said, "What is chus? My Zaidi lived 80 years ago in white Russia, in drunk, in fear of drunk Russian soldiers. And here I am in my homeland, receiving a ticket from my policewoman. I will not sit in an empty jail and rot for 3 weeks until someone bails me out. I won't be molested in jail. I won't be ignored. This is my daughter, it could be. This is my sister. This is my cousin. This is..." And it's Hanukkah, and you know what she's going to do? After she gives me the ticket, she and I are both going to go home and light Hanukkah candles and celebrate Jewish Malchus. I said, "Thank you, Hashem. What is chus? I'm not running away over icy mountains and drunk Russian soldiers. I'm in my country receiving tickets." And remember about 10 years ago, my family went during the summer. We went up north. There's a place called Nahariya, which is all the way up north. It's a beach. And we're walking on the beach, having a good time, and all of a sudden, wait, where's my cell phone? Where's my cell phone? Come find it. So I'll start digging through the sand. Good luck with that, right? About 10 minutes later, okay, phone's lost. What are you saying? Hebrew? Kapara. Okay, it should be a kapara. Kapara. So we continue on, get some pizza, get some ice cream. Then all of a sudden, my wife's phone starts buzzing. Picks it up. It's the police station. "We found your husband's phone." My wife's number was on the phone, so they called my wife's number. "Come and claim it." Someone turned it in. This is about 10 years ago. I've been living in Israel 40 years. This is my first time in a police station. I have to admit, I'm not a drug lord. I don't go to police stations. I'm not a mass murderer. This is the first time in a police station. I walked in there with tears in my eyes, hugging the policeman. "My goodness, my brothers, how long have we waited for this? You know what happened when soldiers came through Jewish towns? Do you know how much terror
women felt? We don't talk about it that much. You know, in the Kishinev pogrom, about 100 years ago, how many women were molested and abused? How many of your grandparents were maimed? How many heads were beheaded? How much blood was spilled? How many blood libels were launched? How helpless we were, how defenseless we were. No one protected us. Look at your Haggadahs. Can I get Arba Badim Dibra Tara, Chacham Rasha, Tam Shanta and Lishal? In some Haggadahs, the picture of a Rasha is a Russian soldier, or a French soldier, or a Spanish soldier, or a British soldier, or an Egyptian soldier, or an Iraqi soldier, or anything. Now, for the first time, there's something called a Jewish soldier, and a Jewish state, and a Jewish government. Hodul Hashem ki tov ki li olam chazdo. Thank you, Hashem. So at some point during this week, see if you can say what I just said. See if you can say Hodul Hashem ki tov ki li olam chazdo. In a way that you wouldn't have had you just gone to those camps that I mentioned before. Because now, you flip your lens. And you're seeing something you would not have seen in the Poconos. Kapish? Have a great rest of the summer.